Good afternoon, everyone. I'd like to welcome you to this session, which is C++ Scenarios for C# Developers. My name is Kevin Pilch-Bisson. I'm an engineering manager with Microsoft. I've worked at Microsoft for the last 12 years. During that time, I've worked on the C# and VB team for the whole time, so I'm pretty familiar with the C# side. But what a lot of people don't know is that up until and including Visual Studio 2013, all of the IDE support and the compiler for C# and VB is implemented in C++. So I've had a career at Microsoft working on C++ code, and even before starting at Microsoft, I had 2 years of industry experience writing C++ code as well. Today, what we're going to cover is roughly two parts to the talk. The first part, we're going to talk about some scenarios where it might be appropriate to use C++, even if you're normally a C# developer. And then for the second half, we'll go into some basics of the C++ language, some of the newer stuff that's coming in that has come in with C++ 11. For those of you who've kind of adopted C# and haven't looked back at C++, it's not the same language that it maybe was when you last looked at it. Before we get started, since this is a little bit smaller group, how many of you guys are using C++ day-to-day now? About half? Okay. And how many of you have a background in C++ before? Okay, so most of you have some background. Great. So let's jump in. What are some scenarios for using C++? One of the first ones is maybe you're bored of writing the same old code all the time. Do you feel like you work on an assembly line cranking out the same websites day in and day out? Maybe you want to challenge yourself a little bit. You want to learn something new. So coding in C++ is fun, right? You can find out what hardcore C++ developers see about the language. You can challenge your brain and get a better understanding of how the machine works and how programming languages work. And then you can bring that back to writing code in C#, right? Having a closer understanding for the lower level systems and how they work, being able to work in that, you can think about what the C# compiler and what the common language runtime must be doing on your behalf in a different way, right? And that can help make you a better C# programmer. This talk isn't about it, but I would also encourage you to learn other languages, right? Just having different paradigms and different ways of thinking about problems can be a very powerful thing to bring back. And so just like getting down close to the metal and looking at C++ is interesting, looking at something completely different, like a functional programming language, is also something interesting. So bringing those paradigms back are pretty interesting. At this point, let's take a quick look at some C++ code. And for people who aren't that familiar with it, we'll take a look at using C++ in Visual Studio. And we'll just do a simple Hello World app to start with. So in Visual Studio, I can create a new project, and there's an Other Languages tab down here in the new project thing for those of you who are used to doing C# all the time. And so I can come into C++, and I can create a Win32 console application, and it sets stuff up pretty good for me initially, and so I can just click Finish. And usually it doesn't take this long to create a project. But here I am with a main method. It's a little decorated for Unicode support and all of that sort of thing. But I can include standard library code like IO streams, and I can do a canonical Hello World example. So that's one thing. So that's kind of a pretty basic program that most people are used to seeing. One thing that I want to point out is those of you who left C++ behind a little while ago and haven't come back, you may not be used to having a great IDE experience in Visual Studio with C++, but a lot of work has gone into making the IDE experience be really great. And so just a couple of small examples of that here on the screen right now, you can see different colors. You can see that T main is colored purple, and you can see that these parameters are colored light gray. So the C++ language service is kind of dynamically recognizing all the different things, coloring them different so you can get a better understanding of your code. Normally namespaces are a blue color. I don't know why that's not happening this time. But we can also see, the cover text is really good for all of these things, although templates do still sometimes get pretty big. They have some heuristics to trim down the size of some of those templates, though. So there's a lot of great IDE features that you may not remember being there in C++ that have been coming in over the last few years. So we can, of course, go ahead and run this with Control F5. And it prints hello world, just like you would expect. So that's the very simplest demo that we're going to do today. And we'll get into some more involved stuff a little bit later on. So what are some things to watch out for if you decide to start coding in C++ for fun? Well, you may be tempted to spend all your time coding in C++. You may fall into the trap of writing everything as a templated method and end up with method signatures that look like some of those ones that you saw there from the standard template library. You may get sucked into religious debates with your colleagues about when to use move semantics versus copy semantics. And you may get tired of all the recruiters bugging you to come take C++ jobs. A lot of people think that C++ is kind of a dying programming language, but it's really not. We see a lot of continued development. There's a huge place for C++ still. Internally at Microsoft, we develop an enormous amount of code using C++, and we're heavily investing in the compiler to make it a more conformant compiler, and the language itself is a living language. There's new standards that are emerging, and so there are a lot of jobs out there for people who are writing C++ code, too. So that's kind of the first intro scenario. Let's look at something that's a little bit more serious. One reason why you might want to write C++ code is because your code needs to run everywhere. There's been a lot of work lately from Xamarin and from other people about multi-device and hybrid applications, so you can use C# and write code for iOS and Android and Windows, and that's great. And there's things like Apache Cordova that let you write HTML and JavaScript and target those same set of devices. That's also great. But what if I need to run on those devices and Linux boxes and Irix servers and my router and any other device, right? There's not a managed stack for all of those things. But pretty much everything that has a processor in it can run C++. And there's a long heritage of portable and compatible code from C++'s C background. It's basically the underpinnings of every system that's out there. And so if you have code that you need to run on the widest variety of machines, C++ is probably your best strategy to get there. So what's a strategy? What's a pattern that you can use when you're doing that? Well, we talk about the hamburger pattern sometimes. So the idea of the hamburger pattern is that you have a UI layer on top that's specific to whatever device that you're running on, whatever operating system or device. You have a small layer on the bottom that abstracts away the platform that you're running on. And then in the middle, the meat of your application can be compiled as a C++ library. And so that's kind of where the majority of your code should lie. And so let's move on and take a look at what that might look like in code. So I'm going to flip back over here. And I have another project set up over here, another solution set up over here. And it has three projects in it. And it has some fantastically complex business logic that I want to reuse on a wide variety of devices. And that's encapsulated in this quiz class down here. So I have a quiz class that lets me load a quiz and get what the next question is and then display what the next question is. And then maybe I want to take that code and reuse it in a variety of different places. Maybe I need to have it run somewhere on a server, on a Unix machine, in a terminal. And so I can build an app in C++ that is a command line app. And this will compile on just about every system that has a C++ compiler, and including all the Unix systems. And I can use that logic, that business logic. And so we can run this app, and it's a little quiz app about some facts about Barcelona. So you can see what's the population of Barcelona. There's about 1.6 million people here, and so on. So this is kind of the logic that we're trying to reuse. But you can see in this same project, same solution over here, I have this Windows 8.1 store app, and I can set it as the startup project, and it does the same thing. We want to have the same quiz logic, but now we want to present it on a different device. And so what we've done in this case is we've used C++ CX to wrap that quiz class in something that can be consumed from a store application. And then we actually have a store application that's written in C++. You can see some of the C++ code for that here. Right? And so if you get a click on the question button, then we ask that quiz wrapper to move to the next question and so on. And so I can go ahead and I can run this app. And you can see, maybe, you used to be able to see. All right, I'm going to move on from this demo since it's not working out. But there's supposed to be a button there that shows you a question. Oh, there is. It didn't show up on my screen down here. It shows up here. So you can see what the question is, and you can click to have the answer revealed, and you can move to the next question, and so on. And so we've encapsulated that same logic in two different places using this hamburger pattern. So we have a small app written on top that's specific to the device, but the majority of our code is down in the quiz logic thing. Some of you who've done this in the past may remember that it's kind of difficult to share C++ code between different things because you might have problems with DLL exports and DLL imports and what data can I share between the two of those and all those things. I want to point out that with Visual Studio 2013 now, we added or one of the developers who works at Microsoft added an extension, and it's called the Shared Project Manager, Reference Manager extension. And so if you go and install that extension, then what you can do is you can create new shared projects, like this QuizLogic project down here. And basically the idea of a shared project is that you can put all of your code that's shared into there, and then when you reference it from one of the other projects in your solution, all of those files are just included in that referencing project. And so you don't even have to build a static library or anything like that. You can just use the same files in the two different contexts. You can have them have pound defines to separate some logic for specific hosts. But it's kind of a great way of managing files that you want to share between different hosts. And if you take a look at VS 14, the next version of Visual Studio that we have some CTPs out, we've kind of pulled that shared project concept into the box so you don't even need an extension anymore. And it also works in C Sharp and VB and JavaScript, I think. So that's kind of a handy way to share code when you're doing this kind of portable system. So along the same theme of scenarios and then gotchas, what are some of the gotchas when you're trying to do portable code? Well, kind of the two biggest ones is that while C++ code can be compiled for just about every device, not all the compilers support exactly the same pieces of the language. And so if you're doing this kind of thing, you might want to stay away from some of the newest and greatest features of C++ because there's a decent chance that not all the compilers that you're going to use will support them. The second thing, I started to talk about it with the shared projects, build system complexities. The shared projects help as long as you're all on kind of Windows platforms, but if you need to target a wide variety of devices, just managing your build can be pretty tough. I have a friend at Microsoft who worked on the Windows CE team, and he said that they used to have a source code base, And they didn't actually know what all platforms it would compile to. Because OEMs could come in and say, well, I want to compile on this platform that has this processor architecture but doesn't have a networking stack, and so on. And so they had pound define set up all over the code to include and exclude things like the networking stack. And so you could check in code, but there was actually no way that you could build the code for all of the different types of devices that might use it. So that's kind of an extreme example of this kind of build system complexity that you can run into. I think they ended with something like 700 different build configurations for building the Windows CE code base. So that got kind of crazy. Before I move on to the next scenario, I do want to say that, again, this is a fairly small room. And so if you guys have questions about these scenarios as we go, there's a mic in the middle of the room, and you can feel free to jump in and ask questions. Or if getting back to that mic is too hard, you can shout them, and I'll repeat them for the recording, and we can move on. So, third scenario. This is the one I think people have been waiting for. You've already tuned your C# app, and it's still not fast enough. Right? So this is a reason that you might drop into C++. I will say that, as a member of the C# team, I will say you can write some pretty high performance code in C#. And one of the things that I like about it is that that often it lets you get to a place where you can think about the larger algorithmic changes instead of the smaller micro-optimizations. With that said, there are still places where you really need those micro-optimizations and you really need to drop down to the bare metal. A couple of examples of those are when you need precise control over when things happen. In my own career, as we've been working on the .NET compiler platform that we call Roslyn, where we've been re-implementing the C# compilers and IDEs in C#, this one's been a big one for us, garbage collection costs. Because we have almost a real-time type situation where, as you're typing in Visual Studio, we want keys to echo on the screen within 50 milliseconds. And if the garbage collector comes in and decides to do a collection for 300 milliseconds, well, guess what? The character doesn't show up on the screen within 50 milliseconds, right? And so we spend a lot of time optimizing our allocation strategies. We stayed in C#. We worked, luckily, with the garbage collector team to make some improvements in the garbage collector for us. But this is the sort of an example of when you might want to do that. This comes up for a lot of people writing games for devices. If you have a game that you're trying to have render at 30 or 60 frames per second on a fairly low power device, again, if the GC comes in and decides to collect for 3 or 4 of those frames, then your game is going to stutter. Right? And so this might be a reason why you want to drop down to C++ so you can have control over exactly when those objects get cleaned up. Another example is just the kind of safety checks that a managed environment inserts for you. They have overhead, right? If you're assigning into an array or if you're iterating over an array in managed code, every time the CLR checks to see if you're inside the bounds. If you assign into it, it checks to make sure that you're assigning the right type. And that costs some. Not a lot in most people's apps, but it costs some. In C++, you take on that responsibility for yourself. You basically promise to the world, to all of your customers, that I know I didn't go outside the bounds of the array, and you have to trust me, right? Another kind of scenario here is where you want to get direct access to hardware sooner. And so, C# now, with the RyuJIT JIT compiler, we now have a library that allows you to have SIMD access to processors in C#, but you've been able to do that for a long time in C++, right? And so that's kind of, and similar things with GPU-based programming. So if you want to get raw access to new specific hardware, a managed environment that's trying to virtualize the hardware from you is probably not going to be the first place that's going to show up. If you want to be right on the metal, then C++ is a great place to be. So I have another slide with some examples. So I talked about low latency situations already, gave you some examples of those. For the bare metal one, C++ AMP is a great example. So there's a library that Microsoft put out for C++ that allows you to pretty easily write C++ code that will run directly on your GPU. And so you can do some interesting parallel algorithms on the CPU just because of the way CPU architectures are set up. And so let's take a little look at that in a demo. And so this one's going to be more interesting because there's two machines involved for the demo. But we'll start over here. And I want to give you an example that shows, you know, even if you do have one of these perf hotspots or one of these scenarios where you want to get access to the machine as fast as possible or to new hardware as fast as possible, you don't have to abandon your existing C-sharp code, right? So we're going to look at some of the interop strategies that you can do here. So here I have a C-sharp program, and it defines a DLL import, a p-invoke method, to call into some C++ code. And then this does the excruciatingly difficult to do on the CPU computation of computing the square of six numbers. But we're going to actually get that to happen on the GPU instead of on the CPU. So we defined a DLL import to say we want to call this method, but we want to call it from C++, from C, actually. And so over here, we have an extern C method, and we'll talk a little bit more about those a little bit later on, that's exported from our DLL. And all it does is it says, well, let me create a view over that data that I can pass, that I can copy into the graphics card. And then let me ask it to run that in parallel on the graphics card. And so you can see here we're using the concurrency library that does a parallel for each. This is very similar to the task parallel library in C#, where you have parallel.for. You can do the same thing here. But the thing that's interesting is the lambda over here on the right-hand side has this restrict to amp declaration modifiers on it. And what that does is it actually restricts what parts of the language you can use to the things that can be replicated in the GPU. And then the compiler knows how to take this and build a GPU kernel out of this piece of code. And you can run it directly on the GPU. And then finally, we copy the data back from the GPU into the regular RAM of the machine. And so I can go ahead and run this app. And we can see just how fast we're able to square six numbers. It didn't take very long. Probably wouldn't be able to notice a difference between how long it would take on the CPU and the GPU for that one. So let's flip over to another machine that I have over here. We'll take a look at a different demo. This is still on a not very powerful laptop. It's just a dual-core machine. It's a low-power laptop that doesn't have a very good video card. But here's a more interesting demo. So let's take a look. This is an n-body simulation. And so here we have 1,024 objects that are moving through space, and gravity between each of those 1,024 objects is being computed simultaneously. And you can see here that it's running at about 16 frames per second, which is about a third of a gigaflop, right? And I can adjust the number of bodies here. I can say, well, not sure why that happened, but I can go up to say 8,000 bodies, and we can see we drop down. We can only manage to do about 9 frames per second here. The gigaflops number went up, but we're going to max out at about 10 frames per second, and so this isn't really a very good simulation. But you can basically run exactly that same code on a GPU, and so if we start this one up. This one, we're still running at the same 10 frames per second or so, but in this case, we have 20,000 bodies as opposed to the 8,000 that we had before. And you can see we're up to 100 gigaflops. And like I said, this is on a low-power laptop. I saw this demo done with a pretty impressive machine that had 8 graphics cards or something like that. And I saw it doing several teraflops and having hundreds of thousands of bodies all going around at 60 frames per second, right? And for just a few thousand dollars, you can build what was not long ago a pretty massive supercomputer. 15 years ago or so, I worked on a helicopter simulator that used Silicon Graphics infinite reality workstations. And that was what they called them at the time, the infinite reality workstations. They cost about $300,000 US, and they're about half as good as a modern gaming video card. So video cards have this kind of great parallelism. And so if your problem domain is one where you're doing the same operation on massively parallel data, looking at something like AMP or another way to get on the GPU can be really good. So what are some gotchas when I'm dealing with performance, when I want to go to C++ for performance? Well, one of the big ones is premature optimization, right? If your app is running slowly in C#, that doesn't mean that the first thing you should do is throw it away and rewrite it in C++, right? It's probably not going to be your best strategy. You should invest in a profiler, see what the hotspots are, see if you can tune it in C#, take a look at your algorithms, and see if there's different algorithms that make sense, right? Don't just look for small changes that you can make. Also look for big changes that you can make. One of my favorite examples of this is changing from doing event-based programming to doing time-based programming. Often, if you look at performance problems, at least the ones that I've dealt with in Visual Studio, if you're looking at typing or something like that, a bunch of events are coming in, and if you end up trying to do a calculation on every event that comes in, then you're going to have scalability problems, because the more stuff you try to do, you have to do it for every keystroke, and so that limits how many keystrokes you can have. A different way to think about that problem is to do, like I said before, to think about it as a real-time system and say, well, how often does the user notice what's happening? Maybe 60 times a second, right? Maybe a little less. And so if you instead say, I will do all my calculations once every 50 milliseconds, then it doesn't matter how many keystrokes happen in that 50 milliseconds. I can still do all the calculations, right? Whereas the first model of doing all the calculations on every keystroke, I get limited, right? So that's kind of one of these algorithmic inversions that is kind of an interesting thing to look at around optimization. But you may end up still needing to drop down to C++, right? Missed or unforeseen causes. This is an example of something that can happen where even though you've profiled, if your environment is not the same as what your customers have, it may not matter. And so a great example of this was someone who came to us with a performance problem, and they spent a bunch of time optimizing it in their test environment. And then when they went to deploy it to customers, they found out that customers were using it over the internet, not on a LAN. And so it didn't matter how much they optimized their code. It was dominated by the network hops that they had. Right? So they invested a whole lot in optimizing code that ended up not being the bottleneck just because it was kind of an unforeseen performance problem. You trade off simplicity and maintainability with performance when you make this sort of optimization, right? Suddenly you have C++ code to deal with, which means, like I said before, you promise not to mess up instead of having somebody that's kind of keeping watch over you. But also, you have to figure out how to get data back and forth between the different worlds if you're doing it through interop. And so you end up with more complexity, more to deal with, and more pieces to install and deploy. And so those are some things to watch out for if you're moving to C++ for performance reasons. Fourth scenario has to do with legacy systems. Seems like no matter where you go, there is old code that is still running. And maybe you need to work with that old code. And so that's a great reason to use C++, because tons of that old code is written in C++. There's systems like banks and insurance and manufacturing and medical imaging and all those things tend to have code that's written in C++, and you want to deal with that code. I don't have a demo for this one, but the next one will cover kind of how to do some of this. So we'll go straight into gotchas with this one. Well, the APIs may not be the ones that you would design. And diving in to look at that code, it may not be the nicest code. It may be that code you remember from 1995, not the C++11 code that we're going to take a look at. And so it can be tough diving into those systems. And again, like I was mentioning with the complexity just a minute ago, that there's different strategies for error handling. If you have some code that uses exceptions and some code that uses return codes, that can be a problem. If you need to marshal data between different layers, then that can be a problem. But the truth is that C exports, they're pretty much the interchange format of computers in the world, right? You can have a C export that can be called from a pinvoke in C# code, or it can be called using JNI, or it can be called from Ruby code, or it can be called from Python code, or it can be called from Fortran code, or it can be called from COBOL code. It's all the same style of export. And so interoperating with these legacy systems, C++ is a great place to do that. So the last scenario that we're going to cover is the idea of critical functionality that exists only in a library that comes from C++. So some examples of that are places where, you know, your company has some existing code that you want to reuse. Or it has some code that you're scared not to reuse, right? You know, your management would be willing to let you write it again in C#, but you're not sure you can figure out what it does enough to write it in C#. Right? Other great examples are if you want to take an OSS library that does cryptography or something like that that's already written in C++, then that may be a reason why you want to do it. Going back to kind of those legacy systems, there's all kinds of compliance issues around insurance and medical systems and that sort of thing. And so it can be an expensive thing to get code to be certified to be compliant. And so maybe you want to continue using that same library that you had because it's already been certified. And then last is, again, on the topic of kind of dropping close to the metal, in any machining environment, automation environment, where you're interoperating with custom hardware, just about always that interop has to happen through C++ code. So those are places where you might have existing C++ libraries that you want to consume. I mentioned cryptography. There's also other things like computer vision. There's some great libraries from academic research around the world that are implemented in C++. And so if you wanted to take advantage of those, then you would probably want to drop into C++. So how do we go about doing that in interoperating with C# and C++ in that kind of world? So let's come back over here. And let's take a look at that same quiz console application that we had before. But so we have that quizzer.cpp and quizzer.h. And so I have the same C++. I have that same C++ class that we were looking at before that has this kind of API. Well, I mentioned that C is the interchange format that all computers recognize. And a lot of people say, well, C++ is compatible with C, so doesn't that mean that C++ is? Well, it comes down to the fact that C++ adds information about parameters, and so it mangles the names that end up in the libraries. And the interchange format that we talk about doesn't really understand the concept of classes the way that C++ does. And so there's some work to do to kind of expose that to C#. So what you can do is you can define a set of C-style methods that provide the same API that you had in that class using an opaque pointer object as the first parameter. So that's basically like passing this parameter into each of these methods separately. And so these do become C methods. And this little extern C up here, that says to the compiler, hey, I want to use these methods with C signatures. I want to interop with other people who are expecting C signatures. So don't do your name mangling. Don't generate names that include the names of the parameters and the types of the parameters and all that stuff. This little native library API, is a macro that's defined right up here. And the way that C++ works in Visual C++, if you define a dynamically linked library, that has a set of exports to it. And there's different ways you can manage your exports. One way is you can have a file that lists all of your exported names. But that's kind of a pain. And so instead, another way to do it is to use a DeckelSpec DLL export. And so that's what this thing looks like up here. So we tell the compiler, hey, this is an export. But because this same API probably wants to be used from other C++ libraries where they want to import it, what we do is we set the project properties to define, for this project, to define this native library exports. And so when we're building this project, they all get marked as exported methods. And when we're building any other project, they get marked as imports, saying they're going to come from some other DLL. So that's where we need them. So that then you just put all of those, you put that macro on all of the APIs that you want to expose to somebody else. And so then they become exported C functions in the DLL. And so just like we were looking at before, if I come over here to C#, I can then define pinvoke methods, DLL import methods, for each of those exported functions in C++. And I can specify that they come from native library. And I just take everything that was a pointer, and I put it into this inputter type. And I can use the framework safehandle class to handle the memory for me. So whenever one of these objects gets collected, it will come down here and call this it'll come down here and call this overridden release handle method that will then call back into C++ to say, okay, go ahead and free the memory. And then what I do is I make an object model that looks like a C# object model wrapped around that pointer. And so I have a load method and a first question method, and I have properties for the question and the answer. And I can write C# code that goes ahead and uses that the way that I would normally write C# code, but under the covers, it's kind of C++ code. And so this might be something that you would want to do if you had an existing library, and maybe you know that that existing library has some functionality that your company has never taken advantage of up until now. But then your boss says, hey, I'd like you to expose this functionality. Well, you can say, well, am I going to start writing a GUI app in C++ to expose this functionality, or can I simply export it and then write the app somewhere else where I'm going to be more productive? And so that's kind of the idea here, is you can jump into the C++ code and export a little bit of it and then make kind of broad calls down into the C++ code that cover a lot of functionality from a higher level language. So coming back over to slides to talk about gotchas in this kind of world. This is not specific to C++, but if you're using one of these libraries, right, then if it's an OSS library or somebody else, then your team doesn't own the code, and so you're kind of dependent on them. Kind of more interesting issues that are the things that you need to think about are what happens if you have too many cross-boundary calls, right? That can affect the performance of your system as you're converting data back and forth between the data representation that C# expects and the representation that C++ expects. And so you want to, again, define a chunky API, something that you can do broad operations in and have the transitions between C++ and C# happen kind of on well-defined boundaries. Data conversion issues. C++ has a lot of ways of representing characters and strings, and so you have to figure out which one your library is going to use and how that gets marshaled to different code or to different languages, and that can be a pain. And of course, if you're doing this with some existing legacy system, then figuring out the exact semantics that are required for object lifetimes can be difficult. And so you can end up with problems around memory leaks or null pointers or buffer overruns. And so you are, again, kind of taking on that responsibility yourself by jumping into C++. Are there any questions about those scenarios that people want to ask? No? Okay. So let's look at some more C++ instead of looking at kind of these toy apps. So for those of you who haven't looked at C++ in a long time, I've mentioned this a couple of times, but forget about 1995, right? C++ code that you wrote in 1995 is not the C++ code that you're going to write now. However, C++ is a pretty big language. So also think about the 80-20 rule, right? Let's pick a few things to focus on that are kind of core concepts. And those should get you most of the way to your solution, or all the way, right? So here's 10 parts of the C++ language. And we're going to talk about the two that are in orange up there. Because the rest of them, you actually don't need a lot of the time, right? I mentioned years and years that I've been writing C++ code, and I think I've used custom allocators once in all of that time. I think I've never had to use variadic templates, for example, right? But objects in RAII, I use all the time. Containers and algorithms, I use all the time. So let's talk about those four sections: objects, containers, RAII, and references and constants. So objects in C++ have four operations. They have construction, copy assignment, and destruction. They actually have two more. They have move assignment and move construction, but we're going to leave those off because you almost never need to worry about moving when you're writing your own C++ code. It's great that they're there for library authors, but you don't generally have to worry about it. So here's some code that constructs an object. In this case, the object is an int. It does a copy construction, it does a copy assignment, and it does the destruction. So those four special operations. Many people say, well, this is an int, it's not an object. And that's not true, right? Anything that occupies a contiguous sequence of memory in C++ is an object. And it has these operations. We can flip over to a custom defined class, and it has exactly those same set of operations, right? Somewhere I have a class, I can construct it, I can copy construct it, I can copy assign it, and I can destroy it. So what does it look like to implement those things? Well, my class might look like this, right? I can have a method for a constructor, a method for the destructor, a copy constructor, and an assignment operator. And if I were to use this example in the previous code, then I would end up printing out constructing, copying, assigning, destroying, right? Which one of X and Y gets destroyed first? Don't know. It's up to the compiler. It can decide. If it matters to you, then you have to manage that yourself, right? Which one of them gets cleaned up first. And you can do that using some of the containers that we'll look at later. So I mentioned objects are continuous blocks of memory. So those continuous blocks of memory have an address, right? I can have a class, I can have an instance of a class, I can take the address of that class and make a pointer to it. P is a pointer to X, star P is another name for X. If I have two different objects, X and Y, then I can get pointers to each of them, and they don't point to the same memory, right? It's like mailboxes, right? A pointer is kind of a mailbox that I can send stuff to, and what's contained in those mailboxes will definitely be different. There is a special pointer value called null putter. Some of you may not remember null putter. That's because it's a fairly recent addition to the language. Many of you may remember all caps null, which was kind of a pound define that went to zero, because zero is equivalent to null putter. But it's kind of nice to have an explicit thing that the language recognizes as the special pointer value. And so there's null putter now. I think they wanted to use null, but it ended up being a pretty hard compatibility thing to get working. And so they ended up using null putter. You should always pick null putter if you're writing code these days. Zero or capital null. They will hopefully fade out as more code gets updated to use null putter. So we talked about everything that occupies space in memory being an object. Well, pointers occupy space in memory because something needs to hold what number they are. And so pointers are objects too. And I can do the same operations that I can do to other objects to pointers. I can construct them, I can assign them, I can copy them, and they go away. They don't actually have any behavior when they're destroyed, but they can go away. So pointers allow you to indirectly refer to an object. In C#, that's not something you get to do very often, right? In C#, the type author decides whether or not you get an indirection to it. So for value types like int, x and y are distinct objects. And so when I do this assignment here, y equals x and then y equals 42, they're different. X and y stay different values. Y becomes 42 and x becomes 0. But if it's a reference type and I add something to it, both of those are referring to or pointing to the same object. Right? And so it changes both of them. So you guys are probably used to that from C#. But in C++, it's always up to the consumer of the type to decide whether they get the exact instance of the type or whether they get an indirection to the type, whether they get a pointer to the type. So, you know, if I had x and y here, I can change x and it doesn't affect y. But if I change star p, then that does change x. So I get to explicitly choose whether I want to be indirected or not indirected. Objects have lifetime and storage duration, right? Objects come into existence, and then sometime later, they depart existence. They're destroyed, right? And so the lifetime is associated with storage duration. And there's three types of storage duration in C++. There's automatic, there's static, and there's dynamic. So automatic storage duration is what we've mostly looked at so far. I define a variable, and it gets constructed. And its duration lasts until the next curly brace, or if it's a temporary to the end of the statement. And then it's destroyed. Right, so the lifetime in these is well defined by the lexical scope of the program. The next one is static storage duration. If I have a global variable or a function defined static, then a global variable exists forever, as far as you can observe in the program. Global variables exist from before your program starts running until after your program stops running. That's their lifetime. Statics inside of functions are a little bit different. They come into existence the first time that function is called, but then they remain in existence until the program exits. So you can kind of use that to remember something that happened the last time that a function was called. You should be careful about doing that. Using function statics and global variables in general, because they can cause problems if you start trying to make stuff multi-threaded, because if different threads expect to have different things stored in those function locals or globals, then you can run into trouble. Global objects, one other thing that is somewhat interesting here, if you have a bunch of global objects, I said that they are in existence from before your program starts till after your program ends. Well, the truth is that your program includes the construction and destruction of those objects. And so there's actually a specified order for how they get constructed, and they get destructed in the opposite order that they were constructed in. So the last and most interesting type of storage duration is dynamic storage duration. And dynamic storage duration comes from when I allocate memory for an instance, in this case with new, until I delete that memory. So here's one where the lifetime is very similar to something from automatic storage duration, because I have the new and the delete in the same function. But I can also cross between different functions. Right? So in this case, I allocate some memory in F in the call to it from the initializer to P in G, and then I release the object, I destroy the object in G. And so the difference here is that this depends on the runtime order that things are called instead of on the lexical scope of the file. So you can't just see by looking at it the lifetime. You have to think about how these calls are chained together. So that's kind of storage duration, and we're going to come back to talk some more about pointers a little bit later on. What about initialization? C++ has four types of initialization now. It has copy initialization, direct initialization, brace initialization. Brace initialization is the newest one, and it's the one you should generally prefer. So looking at D there, what value is D going to have? Well, or what happens if I don't put initializer on it at all? Well, here's where things get a little weird. If it's a global variable, then it's zero initialized, even if I didn't say that it should be initialized. But if it's a local variable, then it's not initialized, unless I explicitly say that it should be initialized. This is, again, kind of coming back to that performance thing. This is you have to take responsibility for things. You can get as close to the metal as you can. The compiler is not willing to say this memory must be zero before you start using it, because setting it to zero might take too much time for your scenario. Right? So you have to decide whether you want it to be initialized or not. You can force it to be zero initialized just by using brace initializers. Right? So you can say, default construct my int with the empty brace initializers. In my class there, that will zero initialize if there's no constructor. But if there is a default constructor that I explicitly defined, then that'll call that default constructor. So that's kind of some basics around objects, right? They have storage. They take up bytes in memory. They have addresses. They can be copied, destroyed, assigned, and created. And all those kind of properties of objects. But that's pretty basic. Most of that's been in C++ for a long time. I probably bored a lot of you going through that section. So let's look at something that's a little bit more interesting, which is around containers, iterators, and algorithms. So back when I started writing C++, there was kind of a wide array of different collection libraries that you might use. There's ATL libraries and MFC libraries and rogue wave libraries and a bunch of different libraries that you might use for collections. But a lot of stuff has changed, and we've got a standard collection library now that has a bunch of great implementations. This is kind of a mapping between some of the standard containers and what you might expect to see in C#. So standard vector is like a list in C#. A list is the equivalent of a linked list. So you know, if you just move to std list, it doesn't match list directly. Same thing with hash sets and standard sets, right? Standard set is actually an ordered set. And so depending on what you want, you might want to go to unordered set, or you might want to go to set, right? So the mapping is not always quite as obvious as you might think. There's actually tons more of these containers, right? There's 50, 100 in the standard, but these are kind of the core ones that you can use most of the time. And if anything, just like in C#, list is kind of the standard one that you should go to unless you have a reason not to, vector is. And so here's a similar sort of mapping between vectors, functions, and lists methods, right? So insert is the same. In vector, we have a pushback method, which adds at the end of it, and erase is the equivalent of removing. So I can use some code. I can declare a vector with a Brayton initializer that says, well, here's six elements in a vector. And I can have a for loop that iterates over that vector and outputs the values. Size t is a type that exists in the framework or in the standard. It's guaranteed to be big enough to hold the index of any collection because it's about the size of memory that's available on the machine. It varies if you're on a 64-bit machine versus a 32-bit machine. So this is kind of something that everybody's seen before, a for loop, right, where I count through the objects. But this works fine on vector, but this doesn't work on set. And it doesn't work on a bunch of other types because they don't have these square brace accessors. And so this isn't kind of the idiomatic way to iterate over collections in C++. Instead, C++ standard collections expose iterators. And so all the collections have a method called begin and a method called end that give you back iterators to the beginning and the end of the collection. And you can use them to walk through the collection and access the elements, whether it's a vector or a set or any of the standard collections. You can use this pattern. And so I can create an iterator, which is a nested type inside of my vector class. And as long as it's not equal to the end, I can dereference it, and that gives me back the current value of it. So that's great, except that writing std colon colon vector angle bracket int close angle bracket colon colon iterator is kind of a pain. And that's kind of an easy example, right? What if I wanted to iterate backwards through an unordered map? Do I have to, without modifying items, do I have to write types that look like that? Really? Well, no, not anymore. So C++ now has the auto keyword, and you can see it there in the for loop. And the idea of the auto keyword is to say, make this type the type of whatever thing initializes it. It's very similar to the var type in C#, right? So it's not, just like in C#, it's not a dynamic type that can change. It's still a complete static type that's known to the compiler. It's just a shortcut for you. You can actually hover over IT in Visual Studio. It'll tell you what that type is. But one of the things that's nice about it is that if I'm using auto, I can decide, well, in this case, I really don't want to have duplicates in my collection. And so I should have been using set instead of vector. And so I can just switch from vector to set, and I don't have to update my code that iterates over the collection. Even though set doesn't have those square brackets, because I'm using the iterators and because I'm using the auto keyword, I can kind of quickly adjust what container I'm using depending on what the characteristics of my problem are and what I need to get out of it. There can be other changes. I mean, if I went to something that mapped, well, now I have to change a little bit because I have to get at the first and the second elements of the iterator instead of just starring into them. But the same pattern works there. So this is okay. I can kind of switch between collection container types pretty easily. But I miss for each from C#. Because for each is kind of more clear that I'm trying to go through the whole collection. And so C++ now has a construct for doing that. It's called a range for. And the idea is you can just say for auto value colon container. So very similar to for each var value in collection. We just switch the words for the C++ equivalents. And because in isn't a keyword in C++, we use the colon, which is already a reserved kind of token there. But this is pretty much the equivalent of for each in C# in C++. And again, it expands back into that same iterator-based thing that does the container.begin all the way to container.end. And so it works on anything that implements that container pattern of having begin and end and iterators. Sometimes you don't want to iterate over the entire collection. Sometimes you want to iterate over part of the collection. right? And so this is why I like having range for separate from regular for loops, why I like having for each in C# separate from regular loops, because it makes it clear that there's something special about the conditions in this loop. They're not just the same old for loop that iterates over the entire container. Here, because I actually use a regular for loop that has the conditions, I look at it and I can say, oh, that doesn't go, the middle condition, the exit condition, that doesn't go to v.end anymore. That goes to v.begin plus 3. Well, what does that mean? The iterator types define operators for integers, actually for size t's, that allow you to specify, give me the first 3 elements of the vector using this sort of notation. And again, the same thing works on any of the container types. So I could change this to a set and say, oh, give me the first 3 elements that are in the set using the v.begin plus 3 kind of syntax. So here's some other examples of things I can do, right? Give it a vector with some elements in it. I can remove, remember, erase is remove from list of t. I can remove the one that's in the third position or fourth position. I can add some stuff somewhere in the middle of it, right? I can dereference it and get the value out of a particular position. I can change things in different places. And then finally, the last one, I can dereference something that's way past the end of the collection. And that's not great, but you'll actually get a debug helper if you do this in debug code that says exactly what's going on. And if you do it in release code, you'll get a runtime error exception that says that you're accessing outside of the collection. So that's containers and that's iterators. What about algorithms? What about things like sort and find that I expect to find on my collections? None of them are there. So what do we do instead? Well, the name of this section in the slides is containers, iterators, and algorithms. And so the way the C++ standard library is built is that these are 3 separate concepts that compose with each other. And so there are containers, and each of those containers expose iterators. And then there's a set of standard algorithms that operate purely on iterators. And so what that means is that instead of asking a vector to sort itself, I pull in the algorithms header, and then I ask a sort to happen on the iterators from the vector. So in this example, I'm saying, take all of the elements from the beginning to the end of this vector and sort them. And there's a bunch of these algorithms. Things like find, right? Where find returns an iterator. It takes 2 iterators and it returns an iterator that you can check whether it's the end or not. Right? So all of these algorithms work in terms of these iterator types so that you can substitute different containers. And if you're using auto, you get different iterator types back, but it doesn't matter. You don't have to update your code to handle it in a different way because you're just using this pattern. So that's using find, which will do a linear walkthrough. If I know that my stuff is sorted, I can do a binary search instead, right? I can do a binary search between begin and end, right? I don't need to use quicksort anymore. And just like I said, there was a bunch of collections available. There's a bunch of algorithms available too, right? So here's a set of some of the most common ones, but there are a bunch more than that you can use too. So let's look at the for each one. For each uses a lambda in this case, right? So in this case, it takes an operation lambda. That's the little square bracket parameter list. Just like in C#, you have the angle bracket thing. Here, you have the square brackets indicate the start of a lambda. And so this standard algorithm will, inside itself, have a regular for loop, and it will call that lambda for each of the items in the collection. You can do stuff like transform a vector, and then this one's kind of interesting. You can see it's got v.begin, and then v.end, and then v.begin again. And so this basically says the second v.begin is saying, put the results into this iterator as you're transforming these things. So in this case, I'm transforming it in place, saying, oh, square each item and store it back where it was. But I can also create a new vector called w, and I can just say, oh, insert it into w instead. One thing to be careful for is that it assumes that the destination collection is already big enough. And so you'll see the initializer passes in v.size to say, oh, make w big enough at the start. But part of this set of algorithms are interesting iterators. I showed one of them before, the reverse iterator, which is a special iterator that you can create that that takes any other iterator and does it in the opposite order. Well, there's also a special iterator that you can get for any collection called a back inserter that says, oh, just add these things at the end of that existing collection, right? Push back for each of those items that I get. So this allows you to do all kinds of stuff. It's very flexible, right? I can use these predicates to have custom comparers when I'm doing a sort, where I take the left-hand side and the right-hand side, and I can decide to sort in the reverse order. So this kind of pattern of everything being built on top of iterators, it's similar in C# to the idea of extension methods that are built on top of IONumerable and link, right? You implement your algorithm based on something other than the collection type. You implement it based on the IONumerable. The thing that's kind of interesting in C++ is that you can use template specialization to get the fastest possible performance for a set of known iterator types without having to go through kind of all of the indirections that you have to go through when you're operating on IONumerable in C#. The thing that's great about this is you don't have to do it, because the standard template library authors have already done that work for you for most of the standard iterators that you're going to care about. But you can define your own predicates that operate on all of these, right? I can define my own method about whether everything's even or not that just uses the kind of built-in things. In this particular example, I can use these iterators again as kind of the interchange format between different containers. Right? So like you have collections in C# where they have a constructor that takes an IONumerable or that has an addRange method, you'll find that containers in the standard template library have these constructors that take a pair of iterators, and they will add all the items from another container between those two places. But what if I don't have one of these collections? What if I have a raw array? Well, there's a built-in function called begin and a built-in function called end that give you back iterators to that array. Because it turns out that the design of iterators and the syntax that you use for working with iterators is basically the same syntax that you would use for working on the raw pointers that make up the array. And so I can also create one of these for a pointer and a count that I'm given. I can create a first and a last iterator that are those pointers. So pointers meet the iterator pattern for their elements. And the last thing to point out is it does often require a little bit of templates, but you can write your own methods like this if you want to. This is what it looks like to write a method like the all of template method, right? It takes an iterator for the beginning, an iterator for the end, a function for the comparison, and it just goes through each one. It's really not that difficult. So that's containers, iterators, and algorithms. The next thing I want to talk about is RAII. This is a pretty common thing C++ people talk about a lot. It stands for Resource Acquisition is Initialization, which I think is very misleading, because whenever people are talking to you about RAII, they're not concerned about initialization. They're concerned about destruction. right? They're concerned about when resources get released, not when resources get acquired. And so the kind of corollary to resource acquisition is initialization, is that resource release happens at destruction. So let's look at that pointer example we had before. We create a pointer to P, and then we call delete P. This is probably C++ code that people have seen before. If we didn't call delete P, then we end up leaking this memory, right? That chunk of memory goes unclaimed forever. If we call delete P twice, or we call delete P too early, then we end up accessing memory that may be being used for something else. And so neither of those work very well. And so, but it's still kind of something that people do all the time, and it can run into all kinds of problems. So here's another example where I have a character array buffer, and I try to use the buffer. At the end of the method, I delete the buffer. Okay, looks great. It doesn't escape this method. I always clean this thing up. What's the problem? Well, the problem is if an exception happens in the middle, then no, I don't clean up that memory. Right? Then we ended up leaking that memory. Or if this is a big method and somebody doesn't know that there's cleanup code that has to happen at the end of it, and they add a return statement somewhere in the middle. Oops, we just leaked that memory too. Right? And so what we need to do, what we can do instead, is we want some deterministic way to make sure that this memory is going to be released. And so, you know, if it was C#, I might have a try finally that says, even if there's an exception or a return in the middle, you know, make sure that I clean this up. But C++ doesn't have try finally. I might simplify my try finally in C# into a using block and put the cleanup in the dispose of the using block. Right? But that's actually not C++ either. In C++, what we do is we take advantage of those object properties that we talked about, and we use the destruction of an object that has automatic storage duration to do the free. And so I can write a simple class like scoped buffer here that says, well, I take a pointer in my constructor, and when I get freed, when I get destroyed, I will release that memory back to the system. And it's guaranteed that those destructors are going to run when we leave that lexical block of code. Whether it's because of an exception or because of a return statement or anything, it's guaranteed that those are going to run. And you'll see down here, we make private copies of the copy assignment, the copy constructor and the copy assignment operator. We prevent anyone from using those, right, with this equals delete syntax. And so that means that there is one and only one person who can go ahead and call delete on this. It never gets called delete. Delete never gets called twice because we made sure that no copies were made. And so I can safely just create this scoped buffer and then use it to my heart's content. We call that an RAAI container, right? But there's a bunch of them built in. The one that's the equivalent of scoped buffer is unique putter. Right? That's built in. There's also shared putter and weak putter for different semantics about whether you want to copy, whether you need to the lifetime to last different amounts of time. But there's a bunch of different things that you can do there. Unique putter is similar to the one that we just had, except that that it does implement some of those move semantics that we talked about. So you can return it from a method, and it will not delete in this case, because you're transferring ownership to the caller of the method. So C++ rule number one, never use delete in your code. The only place delete should ever appear is in the destructor of one of these RAAI container types. There's a bunch of them built in, unique putter and shared putter. If you're using something like ATL, they have their own in com putter, but you should always use one of these. So that's great, but what about the places in C# where I really do use a using block or a finally block, right? They're not about memory management because the garbage collector does memory management for me. What if I used a mutex? Well, there's an RAAI container for that has the same sort of semantics that says, I guarantee that even if an exception happens or somebody returns out of this method, I will unlock the mutex. What about files, right? People have seen these file star things. Well, there's RAAI containers for those as well. And that way I can safely use this use these and make sure that deterministic finalization really actually happens regardless of how we exit the method. I've shown a couple of the built-in ones, but it's also not that hard to write your own, as we saw with scoped buffer. So if I was going to revise that rule number one that we had, I would say never manage your resources manually in your C++ code. Always do it using an RII container. And write your own if you have to, but take a look at the ones that are there already. So the last topic, which I have 9 seconds left, so I might go a couple minutes over, but this is the shortest topic, is around references and constants. References in C# or in C++ are pretty much identical to pointers, but without the arrow syntax. So we said before that in C++, the consumer of a type gets to decide whether they want an indirection or not. There's a convenient syntax for getting an indirection using a reference, which is the little arrow after the type name, says make this a reference. And so in this example, my reference to X, if I assign that to 42, then that changes X as well, because X and RX refer to the same memory location. I said every object has a memory location. In this case, X is an object that has a memory location, and RX refers to that same object. This is often useful when I want to pass large things into methods, because the default would be to copy, construct another vector here. And so if I have a vector of a huge amount of data, I don't want to copy that every time I call a method with that data, so I pass it by reference instead. I say, oh, this method is allowed to refer to the same data. Const, the idea of const is a little bit different than it is in C#. In C#, a const is a compile time constant. The C# compiler has to be able to figure out exactly what set of bytes is going to go in memory while compilation is happening. In C++, const is an indication that once this memory has been filled in, it's not going to change. And so it's really an indication for other programmers, or yourself at some point in the future, to say, I intended this to stay the same. I didn't expect this to change, so don't you go changing it accidentally. And the compiler will give you an error if you try to do that. So in this case, because I defined X to be a constant, the compiler gives an error on the assignment. So you can combine these things together, right? I can have a constant pointer and a constant reference. And so I can say, oh, you know, I can change through my original X, but I can't change through either the pointer or the reference. And this is great for that scenario that I talked about before, where I want to pass things to methods, because I can pass them as a const reference. And so therefore, I can efficiently give out my large collection, my large container of data to somebody else so they can look at it, but they can't modify it. They can't change the items in it. And so in C#, to do this sort of thing, you'd have to end up using something like a read-only collection that then makes a copy of all the data and takes a lot of time. In C++, there's kind of this language concept of const and reference that allows you to let the compiler prevent somebody else from modifying it. So I said that was the shortest of the sections, so that's actually it. I had some related sessions. Obviously, this is the last session of the conference, so you probably can't go to those, but you can check out the recordings of them if you want to. So thank you, everybody. Sorry I went a couple minutes over. And please submit session evaluations when you get a chance. And I can stay here for questions if people have questions for a few minutes. But otherwise, thanks for coming to TechEd.